Welcome to Forgotten TV, the podcast that brings you TV memories of the 70s and 80s, with a focus on short-lived TV shows, pilots, and made-for-TV movies. I'm Chris Cooling. I'd like to acknowledge another milestone for Forgotten TV. The show has received 2,000 downloads as it approaches its one-year anniversary. Thanks to everyone for listening and sharing the show. And if you're a new listener or playing this from a web browser on your computer, the show is available to download and take with you on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, or any podcast app.
Today, scientific investigators the world over are absorbed by a fascinating question: on how many of these stars could life exist? We know, for instance, that in our galaxy alone, as many as 50 million stars could support a highly developed form of life. It's quite possible that our own planet, at some remote moment in its past, had a visitor from one of these 50 million stars.
That is from the 1970 film adaptation of Eric von Daniken's 1968 book, Chariots of the Gods, which postulated that ancient extraterrestrials visited Earth in the distant past and influenced early human culture, including ancient sites like the Egyptian pyramids, Stonehenge, and the Moai of Easter Island, and that intriguing places such as the Nazca Lines in Peru were possibly landing sites for these visitors. Yes, long before Ancient Aliens and similar shows became current mainstays of cable TV programming, Chariots of the Gods instigated a worldwide interest in the subject that lasted over a decade. The pop culture impression of this book and film at the time cannot be overstated. The film was shown at public schools. The 1968 book was an international bestseller and spawned numerous sequel publications, as well as the 1970 film and In Search of Ancient Astronauts, a 1973 NBC TV special hosted by Rod Serling.
Space. An endless tapestry of stars reaching toward infinity. Scattered through its vastness are 100 billion planets on which life theoretically could exist. If only 1% of that life is intelligent, there could be 1 million civilizations out there. And of that million, it is conceivable that one discovered the secrets of space travel. It is possible that ancient astronauts went in search of life beyond their own world and found it on the planet Earth. Is it possible that this planet Earth has been visited by travelers from outer space? Did they wander through the throbbing light years of the universe in search of other life and find it here?
This TV special was essentially a TV adaptation of the 1970 film. In 1977, William Shatner's Mysteries of the Gods was released to theaters with yet another take on Eric von Däniken's ideas.
This rocket launched the Pioneer 10 probe into outer space. It is the first such projectile to leave our solar system. Its journey will last for over 1,000 years. Should some form of intelligent extraterrestrial life happen to discover it on its way, it will find a gold-plated aluminum plaque mounted on it. It contains information about our planet, a diagram of a hydrogen atom, our position in the universe, the beings who sent the craft, a man, a woman. Will this message ever be read? When? Where? By whom? At the very least, this plaque is proof that our scientists are taking seriously the possibility of intelligent life on other planets, other stars, far beyond our galaxy.
One of the print ads read, "Your government is keeping secrets from you. We have been invaded from outer space. A spectacular space adventure for the whole family. Captain Kirk will prove it to you." Interestingly, this film existed in both Shatner and non-Shatner versions. This was at a time when another Star Trek alum was hosting his own investigations into the mysteries of the unknown. For 6 years, Leonard Nimoy hosted In Search Of. And by the third episode, the show was considering Eric Von Däniken-style ideas. Yes, in the 1970s, these ideas fit right in at a time when Bigfoot, UFOs, the Bermuda Triangle, ESP, and anything and everything paranormal loomed large on both the big and small screen. Not only in the numerous pop culture-style pseudo-documentaries, but also in the scripted entertainment programming of the day. Perhaps the most popular integration of Chariots of the Gods-type themes during this period was a series that posited that humans on Earth descended from ancient visitors.
There are those who believe that life here began out there, far across the universe, with tribes of humans who may have been the forefathers of the Egyptians, or the Toltecs, or the Mayans. Some believe that there may yet be brothers of man who even now fight to survive somewhere beyond the heavens.
...1978's Battlestar Galactica featured a ragtag fleet of humans that were brothers of man fighting to survive in distant space, and told us that Earth was founded by their lost 13th colony. Production design on this show featured ancient Egyptian styles. Characters played the card game Pyramid, and one episode was even shot on location at the Egyptian pyramids. One early 1970s show that considered paranormal topics was The Sixth Sense, created by Anthony Lawrence. For 25 episodes, Gary Collins and Katharine Farrar played a professor of parapsychology and his assistant, who attempted to solve supernatural crimes and mysteries involving ghosts, ESP, and all manner of psychic phenomena.
Dr. Michael Rhodes, leading authority in the investigation of psychic phenomena and the world of ESP.
Although you may have missed its original run, many people have seen The Sixth Sense as part of the syndication package for Night Gallery. Anthony and Nancy Lawrence would later create The Phoenix. In Greek mythology, a phoenix is a long-lived bird that is cyclically regenerated or born again. Associated with the sun, a phoenix obtains new life by arising from the ashes of its predecessor. The Greek phoenix likely had an even older origin. Ancient Egyptians venerated the Bennu, a stork or heron-like bird. The Bennu was said to have flown over the waters of Nun in the ancient Egyptian creation myth, and was associated with several of their primary deities. The mythos that developed over the Bennu had it living for hundreds of years, and at the end of its life cycle, building a nest of twigs that it ignites, reducing nest and bird to ashes, from which a new bird arises, a phoenix. Similar mythical birds have been observed in the mythologies of Hindu, Slavic, Arabian, Turkish, Chinese, Japanese, and Mesoamerican cultures. Figuratively, the phoenix could represent ideas such as renewal, rebirth, resurrection, immortality, or the cycles of life, and it has been adapted throughout history to represent any number of spiritual or ideological beliefs, and has been repeatedly used in religious, political, and military iconography over the millennia. The phoenix has also appeared or been referenced countless times in modern-day literature, music, TV, and film. The paranormal culture of the 1970s, as well as the background of the mythical phoenix, gives us a little context for our consideration of The Phoenix, 1981 TV movie, which aimed to combine Eric Von Däniken's ancient alien ideas with the ancient Greek and Egyptian mythologies of The Phoenix. The Phoenix TV movie and later series was created by husband and wife writing team Anthony and Nancy Lawrence, who indeed had read a number of Eric Von Däniken's books. In addition to the 1972 series The Sixth Sense, Anthony had written episodes of Bonanza, The Outer Limits, and Hawaii Five-O. Nancy and Anthony both worked as producers on the 1980s shows Jesse, Lady Blue, and the Twilight Zone revival. They also wrote the 1988 TV movie Liberace. Other than their TV credits, there is little biographical information to be found about them. Mark Carliner was executive producer of The Phoenix. Carliner produced a couple of theatrical films in the 80s, Crossroads and Heaven Help Us, both of which played at the movie theater I worked at. He became known for producing Stephen King TV miniseries adaptations, The Shining, Storm of the Century, Rose Red, and Kingdom Hospital. The Phoenix TV movie aired April 26, 1981, and starred Judson Scott as Bennu, Shelley Smith as Noelle, and E.G. Marshall as Dr. Ward Frazier. With a music theme by Arthur B. Rubinstein, who composed music for Bring 'Em Back Alive, Scarecrow and Mrs. King, The Wizard, as well as the films Blue Thunder and War Games.
When the gods were very young, seeing that men lived like wild animals, they took pity on them and sent to Earth a child of theirs, so that he might teach men the knowledge of the greatest of all gods, the sun.
Act One. We open at some type of archaeological dig in South America. Dr. Ward Frazier visits the site and is ushered into a large subterranean chamber and into a lower burial chamber.
It's a burial chamber, intact. Looks Aztec.
No, it's Mayan,
but with strange differences.
Arrived from Arabia every 500 years, bearing its own ashes.
Have you been able to figure out what the inscription's all about?
It says, "I am the Bennu, the golden light, who brings incense to Osiris."
But Osiris was an Egyptian god. Somebody's got their wires crossed.
It looks hermetically sealed. We'll need more sophisticated equipment to open this.
Oh, we have an institute in our capital.
I doubt if it's equipped like ours.
I don't think my government would allow you
to see it, Barbara. We're not going to steal it. This is still a collaborative effort.
There's only one place in the world with equipment special enough to handle this.
The sarcophagus with a circular symbol of a phoenix on it is taken out of country to a clean room at the Medical Center for Astroarchaeology, where sophisticated scanners are used on it. Large robotic arms slide open the lid, and we get a glimpse of a man submerged in liquid. The man is completely preserved and has a circular, golden medallion hanging from a chain around his neck, with the same relief image on the sarcophagus lid of a phoenix rising from flames inside a triangle within a circle. The man is removed from the sarcophagus fluid and examined by the scientists.
Incredible. The liquid was chemically related to amniotic fluid, like in a mother's womb, but it's synthetic and has unknown elements.
No, he certainly isn't your average American boy. Even an ancient Maya wouldn't have cellular structure like this. Glands, pigmentation. Different. Better.
It all fits, Ward. Don't you see? Ancient astronauts existed. We're looking at one.
No, wait a minute. I'll grant you've made a remarkable discovery, but don't go jumping to a lot of wild conclusions.
It may not be such a wild conclusion, Dr. Frazier. Our history and our traditions are filled with stories of gods who came down from the sky in fiery chariots.
But you're mixing apples and oranges, Egyptian symbols and Incan gods. There's no connection.
What? Many people believe that the Egyptian genius Imhotep was the same god of the Incans.
Look, there's all kinds of evidence that some superior beings were here. Electric batteries, thousands of years old. Numbers with 15 digits, something not registered on any computer. Maps found in the 16th century that could only have been charted from the air.
That's all been explained scientifically.
Can you explain this amulet?
What about it?
We can't get it off. Go on, touch it.
It's hot.
No sign of radiation on a Geiger counter. It's some unknown energy. Unknown.
Later, unseen by anyone, monitors show the preserved man's vital signs coming to life, and he escapes off-screen. Walking down a road, he appears to be glowing as he comes across a young woman in a car that gives him a ride. Shortly, they arrive at the ocean side, where a family in a Dodge camper van is enjoying the beach with a young boy, Timmy, digging in the sand that appears to be deaf. The man removes his shirt and kneels to bask in the sun as the boy and his dog approaches him. The man seems at peace and does not really interact with the boy. He then sheds his pants as well and disappears into the surf au naturel. The woman, evidently a photographer, takes a number of pictures of all this. The female photographer is back at her canyon home examining the picture she took when we find the strange, tall, blonde man on her patio in a yoga pose, meditating.
I found some more clothes. The naked body seems to shock everybody, except you.
Well, I've seen a few in my time, professionally speaking.
Oh, I'm a very good swimmer. I remembered about your house in the canyon and all the plants. They really do help me breathe.
I never told you about all my plants or my house in the canyon. It's not nice to read people's minds.
Sorry.
Are you all right?
Air conditioner. Positive ions.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know about that. Look, I don't understand. You come out of nowhere without your shoes and you glow and read minds and the plants make you feel good, but then the air conditioning makes you feel sick. One of us isn't playing with a full deck and I seem to be at a real disadvantage here.
There is a man. I've got to talk to him. He can help me.
What man?
His name is on a tag you took from the green clothes.
Oh, yeah. I was going to check him out tomorrow and see if I could find out a little bit more about you.
I can tell you where to find him. Go to him. Tell him to come here now. Alone.
You got it.
The woman quickly finds Dr. Frazier.
You happen to lose a 6'4" blonde stud who can read minds and is allergic to air conditioning?
I read your books.
All of them?
Well, they were too demanding.
You think you were a Russian spy or something, the way they're running around looking for you. This young lady thinks you're quite a bundle. Practically a Superman. Can you leap tall buildings in a single bound?
Not without a little help.
Which leads us to why you asked her to bring me here.
I want to tell you something. There are pollutants in your air. Lead and chemicals?
You're not the only one complaining about that.
Well, maybe not, but for me, it's causing a highly negative electrostatic field. It's hurting my body. It's destroying me. I've been able to counteract the damage with some natural elements, but I have to have a more permanent unit if I'm going to survive. Close your eyes. Concentrate. I can tell you faster in images than in words.
Chemicals, minerals, radioactive elements.
Things don't need. You recognize them.
Yeah, I think so. What is this? Physics and alchemy? Sounds like you're trying to change lead into gold.
The making of gold from base metals is merely a discipline. It leads to enlightenment. It's a spiritual transformation. My people, like your ancient Egyptian alchemists, had the knowledge. They knew how to change basic elements into pure energy. And I must have that energy to live. Can you get these things for me?
Get them? I just can't walk into any...
If you can't get these things, I'll die.
Why don't you just come back? Let the government get you what you need.
I am not a thing to be used and examined. I did not ask to be awakened. I didn't ask to be stranded in a hostile place. You woke me. You disturbed my rest. Now accept some responsibility for my life.
But these things you want, I'll need to get clearances. It'll take time and a great deal of money.
Now, how much money do you need?
$500,000.
You'll have it within 3 days.
The tall stranger intuits that a nearby gambling establishment is the best way to raise his needed funds. And we finally get names for our main characters.
Hey, what do I call you? Do you have a name?
It's Bennu.
Bennu. That's interesting. I guess I don't have to tell you mine.
Noel.
I'll get the car.
While she gets the car, Bennu pyrokinetically burns all the pictures Noel took of him. Meanwhile, the boy in the camper van points to a road sign and encourages his parents to head to Coral Springs, the same destination Bennu and Noel are headed. At the resort, Bennu quickly realizes the craps table is rigged and uses his powers to win several plays. This immediately catches the attention of the pit boss, who is present when Bennu reaches his $500,000 goal. He also telepathically directs the boy, Timmy, to choose a slot machine, winning his family a jackpot. And Timmy's mother recognizes Bennu from the beach as he leaves the casino. When the casino manager confronts the pair as they leave, Bennu calls him out for his rigged games. Soon a car chase ensues, and Bennu uses his medallion to blow up Noel's car as they escape into the desert, and the bad guys assume they are dead. Noel gets picked up by a truck and gets the money to Dr. Frazier. Act 3. Dr. Frazier and Noel meet up with Bennu at a farmhouse in the desert, but they've been followed. Meanwhile, Timmy continues to have thoughts of Bennu, and as a result of telepathic contact, is drawn to his location, and he sets out into the desert. His parents report him missing, and the mother casts suspicion on Bennu's motives for being friendly to the boy. Timmy's mother is played by Hersha Paradis from Little House on the Prairie. It turns out the boy isn't deaf, but refusing to speak as a result of his father.
He's chosen to believe his father's only missing in Vietnam.
Tim withdrew into himself when his father was killed.
And he's refused to use his mouth or ears ever since.
He's not missing, Tim. Your father died fighting in that war.
The fire in your mind is real.
He died with courage, Tim. A very noble heart was purified in flame. You can hear me now if you want. The pain won't get any worse. Listen to me, I'll tell you a secret.
There's a center deep inside of you that's made of pure energy.
You know what that is?
That same beautiful sun is right there, Tim. Just like the sun inside of me and every other living creature. It connects us all with each other. It makes us all part of the same world. It's a pure gold light, a warm center that pumps strength and energy. And it's waiting for you to call it into action. Well, look for me to do it. Search for it. Believe it's there. Reach deep, deep inside with your mind. Call on it now, Tim. Believe in the golden light and call on it to help you. It'll come. Believe in the golden light.
Help me! Help me! Timmy! Help me! Help me! Help me!
Stop out,
no!
For the first time in years, the boy cries out, "Help me!" which is misinterpreted by the police as they show up and shoot Bennu. Unnoticed by everyone, the Phoenix medallion dematerializes and transfers to around Timmy's neck, and he conceals it. Act 4. Back at the Medical Center for Astroarchaeology, Bennu is operated on and displays superhuman physical healing abilities on the operating table. His body seemingly healed, something still isn't right. Noel shows up to give him a heartfelt talk about the potential of humanity. Then Timmy comes in, and we come to understand why the medallion went to him earlier.
You can say it out loud, Tim. We don't have to talk in pictures anymore.
I don't want you to die.
Maybe, just maybe, I've chosen the wrong time. I gave you the amulet, Tim, because I thought I was dying and I'd lost faith. Will you give it back to me now?
Medallion dematerializes and returns to Bennu. The sun then rises and shines into his hospital room, and Bennu levitates to receive its energy and somehow escapes the hospital. Act 5. Outside, Timmy helps a still-weakened Bennu into Noel's getaway car, ignoring Bennu's precognitive warning of an unseen semi-truck approaching head-on on a bridge. Noel swerves and plunges the car into the river below. Timmy is retrieved from the river, but Noel is not, and her injuries do not allow her to be saved, even with Bennu's powers. Bennu and Dr. Frazier perform a hillside burial of Noel.
I couldn't save her. I tried, but I couldn't. Like she said, some Superman.
But you've made such a difference in everyone you've touched. Noel, Tim, even an old acid warrior like me. That's the lock between our worlds, Benno. Help us not to seal off our maybe last chance. Your needs are special. Your powers are special.
Special to what end? Will there be another Noel in your world?
There is little I want, or even ask for. But I do want to know you before I die. To call you a friend. I don't know why, but somehow I feel you're a wellspring of hope for humanity.
I'm still not sure. But it's out there somewhere. The reason, the purpose, something defined, waiting for me. My destiny. And I've got to find it.
We close to Bennu in an extended scene, again, shirtless and kneeling, receiving energy from the sun.
Behind the scenes.
The TV movie aired April 26, 1981, on ABC at 7 p.m. Central as part of a Sunday night double feature. It was followed by the pilot movie for the series, American Dream. It had a 90-minute runtime and was on against a repeat of Chips on NBC and the CBS lineup of Archie Bunker's Place, One Day at a Time, and Alice, all repeats. I caught a little Indiana Jones vibe in the opening scene, but this was 2 months before anybody had seen Raiders of the Lost Ark. The character of Bennu as depicted on screen reminds me much of Kane on Kung Fu in more ways than one. Compassionate, caring, benevolent, fighting only in self-defense or the defense of others. Among the powers Bennu displayed were telepathy, the ability to levitate, pyrokinesis, clairvoyance, telekinesis, and rapid healing. Some of these powers he evidently could manifest without using the Phoenix Medallion, while others required its use. The series Bible would refer to this as cosmic energy, which he uses to supplant his own natural metaphysical abilities, which must be replenished. If the Phoenix Medallion, which supplies that radioactive energy, should be lost, stolen, or smashed, his talents are appreciably reduced. The Lawrences wrote the script for this TV movie in 6.5 days after getting approval from ABC. The resulting film was almost what they originally envisioned. Watching this now, it is clear a Superman-Messiah allegory is weaved throughout the film. Superman is directly mentioned several times throughout, and we get an on-screen death conspicuously like the ending of Superman the movie, with lines very similar to those of Kal-El from the film.
I couldn't save her. I tried, but I couldn't. Like she said, some Superman.
Those things I can do, all those powers, and I couldn't even save him.
In addition, the female lead character is named Noelle, possibly named after Noelle Neal, who played Superman's love interest, Lois Lane, for 10 years on both film and TV screens, and continued to appear in various Superman productions for decades. The network was uncomfortable with several aspects of this film. The religious references and implications was certainly one of them. Another was the beach scene after Bennu fled the medical facility. Intended to depict Bennu's childlike innocence and that he came from a completely different time and place, the original edit much more clearly showed Bennu disrobing and walking naked into the surf in silhouette in the presence of 10-year-old Timmy. According to Nancy Lawrence, ABC network reps nearly had a stroke during this scene and demanded it be edited down. In fact, she relates the network people didn't like Judson Scott all that much to begin with. Whether it was his vaguely European appearance or the charismatic way he spoke and gestured during his screen tests, he was not the network's first choice for the role. Were it to become a series, the network required an antagonist be added to the cast to make the show structure more recognizable and appeal to a wider audience, for fear their series would only have a cult sci-fi following. The Lawrences wrote 5-episode scripts and fleshed out a series Bible, a reference document used by screenwriters for detailed background information on a television series' characters and settings, and ABC got their antagonist. However, a writer's strike took place over the summer of 1981, which delayed the start of the fall season. And during this time, ABC began to have second thoughts about a series. The network wanted a change in tone from the TV movie, with its almost spiritual tone, into yet another show resembling The Fugitive. None of the original material the Lawrences wrote for the series was ever accepted by ABC. The position of story editor was given to someone else, and the 4 scripts that got filmed were completely new scripts by different writers, with the Lawrences receiving created by credits. When we come back, we'll look at the Phoenix series episodes that made it to air. The Phoenix will return after these messages.
Friday.
Hello, I'm James Coburn. I know you'll be joining me in the dark room.
James Coburn hosts stories of mystery and suspense, spine tingling twists and turns.
Hey, don't it to me!
Beware of the stories that scare. Dark Room, Friday.
Take heart, America. At last, help is on the way. He may be unable to leap tall buildings in a single bound. He may be slower than a speeding bullet. And he may be less powerful than a locomotive. But he's working on it.
Butterfingers.
Give the poor guy a chance. He's just getting started.
Good God, Ralph. Superpowers.
But when he gets it going, there's no stopping him. Make way for the greatest American hero. He's coming to save us this Wednesday.
Now is the time. ABC is the place.
There's something in the air that says great times are coming your way.
There's a celebration all across the nation. Now is the time. ABC is the place. All your favorite places, lots of friendly faces. you know your favorite shows. It's all right here on ABC this year. ABC. We know what you're after. Drama, sports, and laughter. Now is the time. ABC is the place. It's all right here on ABC. ABC. Now is the time. ABC.
The 1981 writer's strike delayed the start of the fall season for many shows. Instead of new shows coming on in September, some series were delayed until October or November. Such was the case with Darkroom, a new series ABC started airing on Friday nights at 8 p.m. Central in late November. This series was canceled after 7 episodes. After several weeks of specials and out-of-time slot one-off airings of odd shows, the Phoenix TV movie re-aired March 19, 1982, nearly a year after its initial airing. The following week, regular one-hour episodes began airing in that 8 p.m. time slot and did so for 4 consecutive Friday nights. Let's cover each of them, then talk behind-the-scenes info. Episode 1, In Search of Mira, and TV bad guy Richard Lynch joins the cast as the main series antagonist as Justin Preminger. And let's hear the new opening segment.
Long ago, in a remote corner of the world, ancient astronauts landed from a distant planet with a gift for mankind, the Phoenix. For 1,000 years, he has waited, suspended in time. Now, he's awakened to complete his mission. He searches for his partner, Mira, for only she knows his ultimate assignment on Earth. Dependent on the sun for his strength and survival, endowed with a superior intelligence, he has fully developed the powers of the human mind. Relentlessly pursued by those who seek to control him, he must stay free. The Phoenix.
As explained in the opening, a new story element is added, not mentioned in the TV movie. Bennu begins his search for Mira. He only knows that she is buried above the 30th parallel at any of about 2,000 potential Indian burial sites. In this episode, Justin Preminger is some type of government agent assigned to capture the Phoenix at any cost. The idea of Bennu needing to construct an advanced machine to keep him alive on Earth is dropped. Bennu happens upon a murder and escapes from the killers by catching a ride with a local farmer. The next day, the farmer's daughter takes Bennu to Indian Peak to search for Mira, unaware that the killers plan to frame Bennu for their crimes. Episode 2, One of Them, with Andrea Markovici and Mark Olimo, who would later be a regular face on Star Trek Deep Space Nine as Gul Dukat. An exhausted Bennu is being chased through the woods by Preminger and a posse of lawmen with tracking dogs. Bennu uses his powers to mislead the dogs and gets telepathic impressions from Mira, as well as from Yago, Bennu's enemy from his home world. Researching a terracotta stone from Peru, he contacts an archaeology professor who leads him to a burial site in Mesa Grande, Arizona. In a very Raiders of the Lost Ark scene, he uses a cog stone on top of a wooden dowel to throw a beam of light and causes a phoenix symbol to be revealed in a stone boulder. Bennu presses his medallion into the symbol, and the entrance to a cave opens. Inside, he has a vision of Mira and encounters Yago. It turns out Mira was originally there, but was moved. Left for him is a large black crystal. His search is complicated by Preminger, who is one step behind him, and by the professor's jealous ex-boyfriend. And we get a nice episode tag at the end with a little girl who notices Bennu's black crystal.
Look, What's that?
It is beautiful, isn't it?
Can I see it?
Sure.
Boy, I've seen a lot of rocks in school, but never one like this. What is it?
It's part of a meteor.
You mean this came from outer space?
Yes. Oh, there are more beautiful things whirling around up there than we can even ever imagine.
Did you see that story on TV about the lady archaeologist who thinks that spacemen landed in Arizona 1,000 years ago?
No.
Do you think something like that could be true?
I guess it all depends on whether or not you're a dreamer.
Episode 3, A Presence of Evil, with Robert O'Reilly, who later appeared as Gowron on various Star Trek series and video games. Jeremy Licht also appears, and character actor Mickey Jones, who just passed away, appears in an uncredited role. Bennu is hitchhiking and is picked up by a friendly woman, and has to defend her against a couple of rough characters on motorcycles at the local gas station. Bennu finds work as a hired hand at a horse farm near the Hokan Picture Caves, which he intends to investigate. He befriends a young boy and takes him to check out the caves, where he hears Yago speaking to him. This spooks the horses, which throws the boy, and he slides down the hillside into a valley. Bennu levitates the boy to safety. Meanwhile, terrorists have set up shop on the property and plan to take it over and transport stolen uranium to foreign countries, or something. The terrorists plan to kill everyone on the farm, including the new hired hand, before completing the heist. And of course, Preminger is tailing Bennu the whole time, finally coming face to face with him toward the end of the episode. Episode 4, The Fire Within. Bennu is at a bus station and encounters a boy playing the now classic arcade game, Phoenix. He uses his Phoenix powers to get the high score on the game to the admiration of a group of kids.
Dang, it's over.
Maybe you pushed too hard. Why don't you try it again?
I'm tapped out.
You're what?
I don't have any more quarters.
You mind if I try?
You ever played before?
No.
It's a free country.
Timing was probably off.
Yeah, sure.
Coordination. You just gotta become the machine.
Do it again. Show me how you did it.
I'm sorry, I gotta go. 5 free games. And they're all yours, guys.
Thanks a lot. I'll go first.
Later, at the outskirts of a city park, Bennu is sitting, absorbing sun energy, and nearby, a little girl is threatened by a rattlesnake. Bennu touches the ground, communicating to the snake to leave, and greatly impresses the little girl. Her father is a wealthy contractor who gives him a job at a construction site. The foreman takes a dislike to Bennu, and we experience some conflict on the construction site. During his off time, he is investigating Indian burial sites in the area. He also befriends the adult daughter of the businessman, who reveals to him that her father's partner may be swindling the company. Bennu convinces her to examine the accounting records, unaware that the swindler has hired an arsonist to set fire to the building. Soon, they are trapped in the burning structure, and Bennu has to use his Phoenix powers to save her, as well as levitate a box of kittens out of the fire. And at the end, Preminger is prevented by a traffic jam from catching up to Bennu. And just like that, after 5 weeks, The Phoenix was TV history.
Behind the scenes.
This is the shortest-lived TV series I've yet considered on Forgotten TV. And initially, I really had to dig for behind-the-scenes information. Much of the information regarding the production, scheduling, and cancellation of this now 36-year-old show is likely lost to history. Most websites simply have one entry about it, something along the lines of, "Hey, remember that show?" One of the better sources of information I found was a fan site run by Diane Mullen that is no longer online, and I had to use the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive to read it. I could not find any Nielsen ratings information on The Phoenix, but the ratings could not have been good. During its short run, it was up against CBS powerhouse Dallas at 8 p.m. Central on Fridays, which often was the number one watched show of the week. The Phoenix's lead-in was Benson and Barney Miller, quite a shift in tone for the ABC Friday evening. In future weeks, the time slot would be occupied by specials and movies until the fall, when The Greatest American Hero made its second season debut in the same Friday time slot. Of course, ratings may not have been the single deciding factor regarding the shutdown of the show. I mentioned earlier the aspects of the TV movie the network was uncomfortable with, and ABC required a change in tone and the addition of story elements that were typical TV series tropes of the day. From the first episode on, we see the addition of Preminger, who would pursue Bennu as he searched for Mira, who knew his assignment on Earth. Neither of these elements were present in the original movie. Yes, as Nancy Lawrence said, that was the network mentality. Everything has to be like The Fugitive. She related that the series episodes bore little resemblance to the original intent and doubts ABC ever read the series Bible, which fully outlined Bennu's ancient alien origins, home planet, as well as a complete backstory for Bennu's enemy, Yago, all of which were significantly watered down for the series. If you'd like to read the series Bible, you can find it on the Forgotten TV website and Facebook page for the show. As Nancy said, they wanted more of a simplistic children's show, and then The Fugitive thing came in. We felt it had to be more of an anthology to have the latitude to bring in other characters from this planet and from his, but the network put it within stricter bounds, and it didn't work. Thus, from the first episode, we are given a series with the fugitive element, making the show much like Kung Fu, The Incredible Hulk, Liu Kang, just considered in the last podcast, and countless other series, and the show immediately falls into the typical episodic adventure TV tropes of the day, with Bennu encountering terrorists, motorcycle ruffians, arsonists, and jealous ex-husbands, all while being pursued by the series antagonist. Wikipedia and several blogs all state 4 episodes were scripted but never filmed. I actually found a 5th one as well, so let's take a look at those. And there is some script title confusion, as we shall see. Trial by Fire. Bennu, nearly disabled by solar flares and extreme pain, stows away on a small plane, hiding in the cargo bay. When the plane crash lands in the desert, he and the 5 passengers and crew must work together to stay alive. Bennu helps all of them survive while at the same time helping heal the emotional breach between a father and son. Deadly Cargo. Bennu covertly climbs on board a truck hauling toxic waste in Georgia. Thrown from the truck, he hits his head and wakes up with amnesia. Taken prisoner as a hijacker, he ends up on a work farm where he comes to the aid of the warden's 2 young wife, Willow. Freeing himself from the prison, he and Willow attempt to dispose of the toxic waste that is killing people and causing Bennu's continuing amnesia and failing health. The Star Needle. While wandering near a Kansas City zoo, Bennu becomes involved with a young mother-to-be, Reagan, and her special baby. When her drunken husband is murdered, Bennu must protect Reagan from the killer. Preminger sweeps upon Bennu and captures him. Bennu escapes from this trap to again rescue Reagan from her would-be murderer. This episode description is mislabeled Dark Hunter most places online. The Dark Hunter. Dr. Ward Frazier and Dr. Rachel Helfen revisit the archaeological site where Bennu was first found and discover a strange device. This device turns out to be a portal to Bennu's home world. activating the portal, Bennu meets his father, who warns him of Eyewaz and the danger this criminal presents to Bennu and his mission. Bennu returns, only to learn that Eyewaz has arrived on Earth. Bennu thwarts Eyewaz, but not before losing a close friend and his only link to his home. This was fully scripted, written by the Lawrences, and is findable online. However, it is mislabeled the Star Needle almost everywhere. Also, the name of Bennu's enemy, Eyewaz, was changed to Yago for the series. One of my sources omits the Dark Hunter, but mentions a fifth episode script, The Face of an Angel, which had Bennu receiving a psychic message from his home planet. Bennu sickens, and with Dr. Frazier's help, he learns of Mira, and also about people from his home planet that mean him harm. Bennu travels to Tolner, Texas, to find Mira, only to discover she's been kidnapped by the evil people. While he tries to find her, he becomes involved in drugs and murder. This script existed as a work draft, and just by the description, it seems plot elements from this one were integrated into other episodes, and it seems unlikely it would have been produced itself as an episode. Deadly Cargo and The Star Needle were reportedly written by the Lawrences, while the rest were attributed to other writers or writer credits were not available for them. And it is unknown how many of these synopses are from the five scripts the Lawrences wrote that ABC never used. Diane even told me that she thinks two of the episodes were even filmed, although it is not known which ones, or if this for sure happened, as they have never surfaced and were not part of the episodes later shown on the Sci-Fi Channel. The medallion Bennu wears is of interest to many people that became fans of the show. Unfortunately, I was not able to track down who designed or made the medallion, and there were clearly two of them. The one used in the TV movie had a triangular jewel or crystal in the top of the pyramid above the phoenix bird. The one used in the series episode had a cleaner design, omitting this crystal. Over the years, various fan-made replicas have been made and sold, some by professional jewelry makers, and you can still occasionally find one on eBay. Bennu resembles one of the types of aliens once commonly referred to in alien encounter stories, the Nordic aliens. Humanoid extraterrestrials purported to initially come from Venus, and later the Pleiades, who resemble Nordic Scandinavians. Professed contactees describe them as typically male, 6 to 7 feet tall, with long blonde hair, blue eyes, and skin tones ranging from fair to tan. Initially referred to as Space Brothers, UFOlogist George Adamski is credited with being among the first to claim contact with the Nordic aliens in the mid-1950s. And scholars note, accounts with beings with features described as Aryan often include claims of telepathy, benevolence, and physical beauty. Reports of the Nordic aliens dwindled after the 1960s. The Phoenix inspired several fanzines of the 1980s. Long before the internet, fanzines were fan-published newsletters that were hand-circulated among friends, mailed to fans, and you would find them at independent bookstores, comic book shops, and video stores. One of the earliest, if not the first TV show to have such invested fans was Star Trek. Fanzines would contain original art, episode guides, original stories now called fan fiction, and news about what the actors were up to. The Phoenix even inspired its own convention. In August of 1984, fans held PhoenixCon 84 at the Holiday Inn in Annapolis, Maryland, and featured guest of honor Judson Scott. Thus, the Phoenix joined a very short list of TV shows that inspired a convention. By the end of the 80s, conventions became an established for-profit business model, due mainly to the popularity of Star Trek. But once in a while, there were small, non-Trek, fan-run conventions with a single TV show theme, such as Space 1999 or Starman. Likely, the Phoenix is the shortest-lived TV show ever to have a convention based on it. Judson Scott was a 6'4", relatively unknown stage actor when cast as Bennu, but he became known for his genre roles. Not 2 months after The Phoenix went off the air, he appeared as Joachim, an uncredited role in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan. Then, The Powers of Matthew Starr, Voyagers, Greatest American Hero, V the Series, Star Trek The Next Generation, Star Trek Voyager, Babylon 5, and The X-Files. Here are some of his memories of The Phoenix.
The Phoenix was a series that I starred in about an alien who's discovered in an archaeological dig floating in amniotic fluid in a sarcophagus. They open up the sarcophagus, but he hadn't fully regenerated. So he kind of wakes up in a haze, and he doesn't really know why he's on Earth. He knows there's a purpose that he has, but he doesn't know what it is. We were trying to make it seem like our shared human condition, that we're all kind of wondering, you know, when we look at the stars at night, why are we here? What are we doing? So this Bennu character is quickly grabbed up by the government and studied because they know he has telekinesis and telepathy and things that we know we have. But so he didn't have, like, superpowers. But I escape, wanting to find out why I'm here, and the government agent follows me around from town to town. Every episode I was in another town helping a kid with his cat or a farmer grow his grapes. So that's what that was about. And it was just like cogs in a wheel. I mean, there were 15 other guys that I was auditioning, screen testing with on a sound. This is a proper screen test with 35mm cameras back then. I had no problem. I had no fear. Handsome stars, whatever. I wasn't worried. I said, this is my character. And I just had total belief that I was this, because I felt like that in New York, this alien California guy with no real home, just wanting to make everything beautiful. And I kept that feeling. I kept that through the long, treacherous road of the pilot being shot, of waiting to find out if the pilot got picked up, of the episodes being written and given to the network. Well, I'm not sure. Before we give you a full order, we've got to see changes. Then the episodes being accepted, then the episodes being shot, and all the time in between was a year-long writer strike, which stopped the whole. So we lost people. And anyway, it was amazing that it was the cult show that it's turned out to be. It was a sweet little show, The Phoenix.
So when was that? What year was that?
81, 82, right. Just about the time I shot The Wrath of Khan. Right after we wrapped The Phoenix, they asked me to come and play Khan's son in The Wrath of Khan.
Judson is a champion surfer. He began surfing at age 9 for Hobie Surfboards. Also, as you may have been able to tell, Mr. Scott is very spiritual and is a member of the Self-Realization Fellowship. Although he seems to have no public social media presence, he has been somewhat active on the convention circuit over the last couple decades. Richard Lynch was known for many TV and film roles. He almost always appears as a villain and was on Buck Rogers, the 1979 TV movie Vampire, Galactica 1980, Manimal, Automan, several Full Moon Entertainment direct-to-video films. He was very much a working actor with 161 acting credits and will pop up again and again on forgotten TV. He died in 2012 at age 72. Falling far short of an amount of episodes needed for TV syndication, The Phoenix has rarely been seen again on TV, although it was rerun on the Sci-Fi Channel. There was a VHS release of at least the pilot movie, but it has never made it to DVD or any online streaming service. Due to the obscurity and extremely short life of this series, as well as the rapidly shrinking market for DVD sales, it possibly will never be released. Recordings of a 1994 Sci-Fi Channel airing are viewable on YouTube. While interest in extraterrestrials and the paranormal has always been around to an extent in popular media, appearing in radio programs such as Coast to Coast AM, as well as shows and movies like Stargate, The X-Files, Prometheus, and the polarizing fourth Indiana Jones film, the popularity specifically of the idea of ancient alien visitors to Earth has surged since 2009, when Ancient Aliens made its cable TV debut. Over the past 9 years, 135 episodes have aired on the History Channel, instigating numerous imitators, internet memes, as well as pop culture parody. Although characterized as pseudoscience by the mainstream, and even though a number of well-reasoned and fully referenced critical rebuttals to Ancient Aliens and Chariots of the Gods have been produced, interest in the ancient alien theory and paranormal topics in general has not waned. This reminds me of the words of Criswell in the opening lines of a certain 1959 film that still ring true. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. Next time on Forgotten TV. It's a journey through the forgotten TV era with Ernie Hudson as we take a look at his TV roles, including the short-lived Highcliffe Manor and The Last Precinct. That's next time on Forgotten TV.
Oh, you guys.
Forgotten TV is not affiliated with ABC, Mark Carliner Productions, or Anthony and Nancy Lawrence. The Phoenix and other mentioned series and associated characters are the property of their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. Audio clips are included for the purposes of review, commentary, and criticism only, and are not intended to infringe. And I'd like to thank the following YouTube channels for making audio clips in this episode possible. Labreck Fun Channel, That's Cool, Weird Lectures, In Search Of, NBC Classics, Sixth Sense 1972, Pizza Guy 2002, Nanto's Commercial Breakdown, VPR 2B, as well as TimeTravelTV.com and the book Science Fiction Television Series 1959-1989 by Mark Phillips and Frank Garcia. The Phoenix background music track was composed by Mattia Cupelli, with special thanks to Diane Mullen, Marley Kennedy, and the Judson Scott Fan Club on Facebook, as well as the Phoenix starring Judson Scott Facebook page. Forgotten TV is a member of the Frequent Wire Podcast Network. Listen to other great podcasts by clicking the link to Frequent Wire in the show notes. And remember to listen to Walnut Grovecast, where we discuss episodes of Little House on the Prairie. Be sure and like the Forgotten TV Facebook page and follow Forgotten TV on Twitter. All of that is linked up for you at forgotten.tv. I'm Chris Cooling, and this has been Forgotten TV.